'cause I'm a pretty little baby. Don't cry, my pretty little baby. Bye bye. Don't cry, my pretty little baby. Don't cry, my pretty little baby. No more crying. Haven't you heard the sun is shining just we two?
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronek. I'm happy to host this show today, and that's no joke. Yesterday is April the 1st, April Fool's Day, and you know, I was surprised when I did research today that an awful lot of people in the media, in the professional media even, commercial stations, public radio stations, they do jokes, they do funny stories on the air that are not true, that actually you're misled by. Might even lead you to do something differently, mistakenly. And I just wanted you to know that everything this day is, on this show anyway, is true, as best I can find out. Okay. By the way, April Fool's Day is celebrated in different countries around the world on the April 1st, April 1st of every year, sometimes referred to as All Fools' Day. It's not a national holiday, but it's widely recognized and celebrated as a day when many people play all kinds of jokes and foolishness. It is marked by the commission of good-humored or funny jokes, hoaxes, and other practical jokes of varying sophistication on friends, family members, teachers, neighbors, work associates, and so forth. I never liked it because often the jokes that some people do are cruel and or dangerous and hazardous by their consequences. You know, acting on false information can lead you to a very unfortunate conclusion. So I never liked it for that reason, because some people don't know how to do good-humored, innocent jokes. And it does waste an awful lot of time, too. And you say, well, you know, comedy is good for it. Yes, it is, but I think you need to expect it. Okay, I do think that's even makes it even funnier. So I don't want to waste your time, but some of the great well-known pranks is like 1998, Burger King ran an ad in USA Today, okay, the big national newspaper, Monday through Fridays, saying that people could get a Whopper for left-handed people whose condiments were designed to drip out of the right side. Not only did customers by the new burgers, but some specifically requested the old right-handed burger. How gullible are people, huh? How gullible. Now, I got a couple of emails today, too. In fact, I had to do like twice as much research time. Yes, I do research. I do research for this show because most of the stories I had to check, I had to click through, as they say, about internet information to find out if they were legitimate or whether it was just crazy. Let's see, another one that I liked here. In 2010, that was just last year, a British newspaper, The Sun, which is a big British newspaper, ran an article about its new scratch and sniff newspaper, providing a sample of just plain newspaper. This led to a lot of readers sniffing the paper in an attempt to smell the scent. And that's really crazy. So let's see here. Oh, I like this one. This one came from a NASA website in 2005. Okay, a news story was posted on the official NASA website purporting to have pictures of water on Mars. When you click through, the picture actually was just a picture of a glass of water on a Mars candy bar. And so there you go. Apparently, National Public Radio has done a put-on story. That's NPR, every April Fool's Day. I bet they won't do it this year. In other words, it looked real, but when you started reading through it, things got weird. Okay. Now, the problem with April Fool's Day also is that a lot of news stories that happened on April 1st were doubted and not acted on. Although, ominous here, the AMC Gremlin, remember that car? It's American Motors Corporation, which was George Romney helped to start that, was president for a while. In 1970, on April 1st, they introduced that car. And, of course, it did have a lot of gremlins in it. It actually was a problem there. Be careful out there. But a lot of people doubt stories that they hear today. Again, do not doubt anything we say on this show because, as far as we know, it's true. And we're joined in the studio today by a couple of true, real persons that have to do with the upcoming play that's going to be presented in Adderley Auditorium here at Henry Ford Community College starting next Thursday, April 7th. So I welcome our guest and my co-host, Dennis Reimars, has magically appeared. I know you wouldn't miss April Fool's Day, right, Dennis?
I can't wait till you go back into your office, but I'll just leave it at that. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Good to see you, Jay.
Something's in trouble. Somebody's going to be in trouble.
Yeah, it won't be me.
So we welcome Jerry Jablinski from the HFCC Theater Department, the director of our theatrical productions, and introduce your guest and the person you brought with you, please.
This is Tim Beeson. He's one of our theater students, and he's playing the role of the friar in Romeo and Juliet.
Aha! The friar in Romeo and Juliet.
Friar Lawrence.
I'm trying to remember. Tim, what's the nature of that part? What does the friar do? I believe he's trying to help the young lovers, the tragic story, ultimately, of the young lovers, Romeo and Juliet. Is that right?
Yes, that's actually very true. It's he's trying to help everyone in this situation. He believes from marrying them, the two lovers, that he can get the two households to stop fighting because they'll be married, and it wouldn't really look very good with the prince there and having, you know, them fighting against each other and all that. It would just, it's very, very rough.
So he marries them in private.
He marries them in private.
If you will.
Secretly until they can figure out a way to reveal it so that everything turns out right. Unfortunately, circumstances with all the tensions between the two households prevents that from ever happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it's a multifaceted play. Maybe, Jerry, you can give a little background here. A lot of people, perhaps, are familiar with the several movie versions of Romeo and Juliet. Mm-hmm. In my day, I preferred the Franco Zeffirelli version, mm-hmm. which was the first time I think it was actually cast with actors who were close to the ages of the supposed characters in Shakespeare's play.
Right. Very romantic version, both in terms of the cinematography and the acting.
And with young people in the roles to attract young audiences. In Shakespeare's day, would both these parts have been played by men?
Yes, both of the plays, both of the roles, Romeo and Juliet, would be played by males. Juliet would have been played by a male apprentice actor who would have actually been an adolescent, male. And Romeo would have been played by one of the younger adult males, someone in their late adolescence, most likely.
Right, nothing strange going on there, folks. As a former English professor, I know that it was just sort of forbidden on public stages, like the Globe Theater anyway, which was in London and sometimes frequented by the Queen, to have women.
Right. Women were not allowed on stage. That was the convention because the actors, or some of the actors, were thought to have dubious moral qualities, as some of them do today. And, of course, that was not exclusively true. Shakespeare was a family man himself.
Right.
But some of the actors did have dubious moral qualities. And so the convention at the time was that women were not allowed on stage. So anytime there was a female role, it was played either by a young boy apprentice actor, or if it was an older female role, it would be played by an adult male actor.
Well, and of course, I think more recently there was the version, I don't remember the director's name, but Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes starred in a film version.
Yes.
Which I thought was, they added a sort of a rock and roll soundtrack, and they tried to change a lot of the elements. And I love to experience interpretations. But in this one, in several cases, the warring families, or the kids anyway, were, in Shakespeare's day, I think the phrase was fighting with daggers at one point, or at least
daggers and rapiers, yes.
Right, swords, as people know. And in the movie, they actually had Colt 45 pistols, which they did a close-up on, and engraved on it said dagger. So that was either the company name or whatever there.
In-joke, sure.
Yeah, right.
So what they did there is they did what many directors do, and that is they take Shakespeare and they move him to a different locale and or period in history. For a couple of reasons. Number one, to show the universality of the themes within Shakespeare. And number two, to give you a new take on it and hopefully make it more relevant to the audiences. So with Leonardo DiCaprio, right, attracting the young audiences, and with updating it to contemporary New York and street gangs, right, making it more identifiable in terms of the action, the dialogue, and the themes.
Real quick question, Jerry. Now, I know from an article I saw actually in the Mirror News that you had said things, a lot of the reasons why certain plays are picked for production are based on, because this is a learning experience, and we have to make sure that the actors, I mean, this has to be a fit, and as well as the audience, I'm sure.
Sure.
So I guess my question, and this was, I'm told, one of the easier Shakespeare challenges.
Yes, it's one of the easiest Shakespearean plays in terms of its text.
Okay. Now, so my question to Tim is it easy? I mean, this is challenging, I'm sure. And I'm looking at the little poster here, and we have a fight designer, choreographer, if you will.
Choreographer,
dance.
Yes.
We have a lot of things going on here. How challenging was this for you, Tim?
Well, it definitely was one of the more difficult plays that I've been a part of. I've been in maybe one Shakespeare performance before, and I won a parody of it, which is not really Shakespeare. But again, it's the language is really the most difficult part of it. You just have to understand it is the hard part. And when you work against other people and you read it out loud and you gain the emotion behind it, it suddenly all clicks together. There's this moment where it's like, I understand this. Even if you don't answer, you can ask someone, you can ask Jerry or one of the other actors, and they can give you a close interpretation of it, and it just becomes so clear, and once you understand it, you understand the emotion, it just sort of all happens into place. Everything just sort of feels right.
So do you go around talking around your house in Shakespearean language, irritating people?
Well, irritating
what
people,
ho?
No.
what ho?
I usually just wait until everyone's out of the house and just stand in front of the mirror in my room.
There you go.
Yeah.
But just to get back to the issue of language, yes, so the actors are studying their script. They're rehearsing their script. They're applying emotion to the moments. And, of course, they have resources, not only myself, but we have an assistant director, Angie Lai, who's a graduate student in directing from Eastern Michigan University, who's doing a placement, and she's also our dramaturg, so she does the historical research, and she can assist with a textual interpretation, as well as cultural and historical facts and backgrounds.
That's huge,
to
yeah.
help the actors understand what's happening. We also had another dramaturg, Sarah Leahy, who is an undergrad at Eastern, and she was also assisting with that as well.
The big line in from New York method acting schools of the 50s was, mm-hmm. or supposedly this line was attributed to Marlon Brando on set in Hollywood sometimes.
Sure.
Hey man, what's my motivation? And of course, giving the historical background of the play, because Shakespeare did base a lot of his themes on historical activities, both in England and other countries. I just wanted to ask you, Jerry, what's, as the director of the play this time, what sort of interpretations? I know that the play has been promoted here as being a condensed version. I don't want to scare people away, folks. I know that most theatrical presentations of Shakespeare is edited, in other words, shortened for the sake of keeping the action going, and maybe some scenes, in fact, written in Shakespeare's English in the 16th century or 17th century,
English.
Elizabethan
yeah.
English, mm-hmm. Would be less understandable to people if presented with those exact words. So, number one, Jerry, is this a modern language adaptation, or are you trying to at least keep the great poetry and significance of the original play?
We haven't changed any of Shakespeare's language. We
okay,
have simply
good.
Edited certain lines and shortened certain speeches that would either be difficult to understand because they had a lot of contemporary references that mm-hmm. the modern audience wouldn't get,
right.
or things that we just thought were a little too long. Mm-hmm. And so we shortened them. So the running time of the show is 95 minutes, not including the 1 15-minute intermission.
So there's no need to add water to this condensed production.
No, I think okay. there's plenty.
I'm sorry, like condensed
fluids,
soup. That's
yes.
my joke for the day, and I apologize.
April Fools.
Yeah.
No,
let's hope
right.
it is.
No, and for example, I think the only time in just because I know something about films that Hamlet. Was ever presented, at least major productions of Hamlet, on film as a feature-length movie, was Kenneth Branagh's version. And
right.
Because he starred in it, and he was egomaniac. And we're going to do every scene, every line. I think it went almost 3 hours.
Oh, certainly.
Boy, was that. But he enjoyed it.
he's a wonderful
all
actor.
The screen time. Yes, he did a fine version, although set design was a little dull. But he did a very fine version, certainly, of that, Mel Gibson. But I just want people to know is that almost all Shakespearean plays are pared down somewhat. I think condensing or editing or abridgment is really kind of an unfair connotation because of the clarity of some scenes versus the lack of clarity in others for the audience. But it's a great challenge, certainly, for Tim to get that historical background, try to put the emotion and the intonation of your delivery of lines into something close to their true meaning, right?
And yeah, it is. It's very difficult. In fact, the most difficult part of it is getting the articulation down very correctly because there's a lot of art thous, and you have to really pronounce the T's. When you don't do that, it sounds like you're just slurring the line, and it becomes mumbled, and it just the audience loses everything that you're trying to say.
Right, they might misinterpret it to mean my toe or something.
Yeah, my toe or something.
My toe, George. What the heck? Yeah, so as long as you're clear, they get the right words, and they, oh yeah, art thou, that's an Elizabethan. They probably can figure that out if they have any frame of reference from their high school days. But
right, we've got a little glossary in the program.
Oh, really?
We've
cool.
got a display in the lobby that gives some of the historical and mm-hmm. cultural background. And so, you know, it's quite easy to get oriented to it, right? And we've designed it to make it fun as well. We've got a professional fight choreographer, a professional dance choreographer, some wonderful costumes by Judy Fletcher, wonderful scenery painted by Kate Orwig, wonderful lighting by Jennifer Gazdecki and Yolanda Aquino. So we have some wonderful visuals.
Plus the staging. Now, I know that theatrical productions, our Adria Auditorium will seat 400 mm-hmm. Some out people. Mm-hmm. And yet the problem with that kind of production for some people, some people in the community, myself included, I wear glasses and my hearing's not what it used to be, all those loud rock days of the 60s, and I need to sit a little bit closer. There's no problem with that kind of involvement, and even the intensity of the theatrical experience is increased. You're going to do this with a limited number of people all seated really close by on the stage.
That's correct. We're seating the audience in what's called a thrust configuration, which means that the audience sits on three sides of the action, which is very similar to what would have happened in an Elizabethan theater in Shakespeare's day.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we have the balcony for the balcony scene, and we have the area underneath the balcony, which was called the inner below. And so the audience, about 100 for the public performances on the weekends, will be seated on stage. Then when we bring in the high school groups for the three matinees on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, the 11th, 13th, and 15th of April, we're going to be bringing the action down onto the apron, and the high school students will be seated in the regular house, and we are sold out for Monday's performance with those high schools. And so it'll be a different staging. So we've actually rehearsed two different stagings of the play.
Think some of the act, Tim, you're going to be scared with all those people up close?
Oh, no. It's even more exciting because you can do so much more with the, and they will be able to see everything.
Yeah, you can play right to their emotions. You can feed off their emotional responses
exactly.
better.
And
yeah.
It's awesome. You can, with this, the thrust performance that we have, you can turn around. You, for the proscenium, you're always facing the front for the most part. With the thrust performance, you have people on all different sides of you. So you can face any direction, and it, for me, as personally, I find this a little bit more realistic as to, like, just to be able to, like, turn around and just look at a person instead of, like, standing next to them sort of in, like, halfway through so that you could, the audience can still see you. When you're in the thrust performance, it's, I don't know, just from rehearsals and just having just the stuff set up now for where everyone's going to be sitting and entering and everything, it just seems, it feels right. You have this whole situation, you have the building, the balcony, and you have this, I can't even really explain it, I'm sorry about that.
That's
just,
great.
It's just that feeling you get, it's, a lot of it of acting is feeling and understanding your those feelings.
Okay, what we're talking about here, folks, if you tuned in late, and shame on you, but you can go to the website and hear it from the beginning after 2 o'clock on today, Friday, April 1st. Romeo and Juliet is going to be presented here live, a live theatrical presentation at Henry Ford Community College, presented by the Fine Arts and Fitness Division. And this play will definitely improve your fitness, no doubt about that. Well, important themes. We can talk about the themes a little bit, but I think it's going to be great. We did talk about limited seating, and so it's going to start on April 7th. It's going to run through the 17th. Now, that's Thursdays through Sundays, April 7th through 17th. So it's really only two weekend runs from mm-hmm. Thursday through Sunday. Thursday
Correct.
Through Saturday at 8 p.m., so Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 8 p.m. start time. Sundays at 2 p.m. only. Adults, $12. Students with ID, $10. Children, 12 and under, $6. If you have a group of 10 or more, $7 a seat. But what you might want to do, this is not usually the case, but what you might want to do because of the special seating and because of the popularity of this play, is call for a reservation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's 313-845-9817. Now, you can also email Jerry, but it's his first letter, his middle initial, and his last name, which sometimes can be confusing to say over the air. I'll just say it once, GADZUIBLINKI at hfcc.edu. But the phone number is easier, 313-845-9817, at least over radio anyway. Jerry, they just have to give their name They don't have to give you a credit card or anything?
No, we're not equipped for credit card at this time.
And the number of people.
And the number in their party and the date of the performance that they'd like to reserve those tickets for. We'll hold those tickets for them at the box office and cash only at the box office, please.
Okay. And is there a cutoff time you're going to, like, when the play starts, you're not going to hold them longer? Or
some
people let those tickets go at 10 minutes to or whatever.
Right. We release any unsold reserved tickets at about 5 minutes to curtain.
About 5 minutes to curtain. Okay. So, and I suggest, of course, the reserve tickets are not reserved seats, although every seat is going to be a fine seat, certainly with the limited seating display.
Yes, it's general admission seating, but you can. Mm-hmm. You can get a good seat in each of those 100 seats.
Okay, why this play? Tim, as an actor, why do you think this play is important to see, especially in the live drama version, which will make it even more powerful, I think, than some of the great movies?
Well, I think it's because it's just got a really good message, I think. Which is, don't be ruled by love. Love is important, yes, but and also don't be ruled by anger. Which is with the households. You have the lovers who are ruled by love, and they sort of lead themselves into this tragedy. But you also have the houses which are ruled by hate for each other.
The two warring families.
Yeah, the two warring families.
Spiteful families.
Yeah, spiteful families. And if it wasn't for the hate, there wouldn't be a tragedy. So, and you also have all the reactions of all the characters. You have the reactions of Romeo and Juliet and the friar and the head of the house of the Capulets and the Montagues, the two warring families, and you have the nurse, and it's real people who are up there, and it starts off as something amusing, but then it becomes so much more once people start, you know, dying off.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it gets serious when you start killing people. The families, Jerry, I'm trying to remember, again, this is set in Italy, supposedly.
Yes, in Verona.
Okay, but we're not talking about necessarily mafia gangs fighting each other.
What you're talking about.
The two families, I can't remember exactly. What is the difference? Is it just some sort of long-standing, like, Hatfield and McCoy thing?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a family feud. And this
is part. It doesn't really have a clear
of where Shakespeare.
Genesis.
No, it doesn't, yeah. Because this is where part of Shakespeare is taking this from history.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There were feuding families.
Sure.
Right? The feuds would start, typically, when either one member of one family felt or was insulted by another member of another family, mm-hmm. or someone was cheated in business. And then the families felt obligated to be vengeful for that family member who was insulted or cheated by the other family.
Mm-hmm.
So it was going beyond the rule of law. The laws were there and they dictated civilized behavior. But they avoided the law, they circumvented it, and they attempted this revenge. And Shakespeare is deliberately unclear as to the source of the feud, because the source really doesn't matter. It's the results that matter.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Plus, pointing out the idiocy of it. I mean, if there's no firm reason for the start of it, or it's just lingering on beyond people's understanding of why it happened, it's going to cause conflict in our world. It's just completely unjustified, unmotivated, and it shouldn't happen that way. I hope one of the morals here is not if young people come to this play, Mom, from what I saw in the play, I think I need a cell phone. So that there's no miscommunication, you know, between. But let me tell you, folks, Facebook and Twitter and even voicemail can be just as easily misinterpreted as anything that happened in Romeo and Juliet, which you might say, because they didn't know what was happening at a distance, they didn't have cell phones in those days, that caused the real tragedy at the end. Not true, folks. Communication is difficult at best, believe me, as a telecom professor. And even with Facebook and Twitter and voicemail and emails, you can still misunderstand what's going on at a distance and make the wrong, draw the wrong conclusions and engage in the wrong action. So this is just, wow, what more can we want here? Great sets. It's lighting, acting, dancing, fighting, simulated, another great production, I'm sure. But get those reservations in, folks, if you're interested in Thursday through Sundays, April 7th through 17th, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays at 8 p.m., Sundays at 2. Something to do with the whole family. Kids will enjoy it, and I believe it's easy to understand. And because of the being up close and personal with the actors on stage too, it you're going to get the emotion and the meaning quite easily here. That phone number for reservations again, 313-845-9817. Anything else you'd like to say about your experience in this play, Tim, as the friar?
I got to say, it's been one of the most rewarding roles that I have ever had. It has just been so much more. There's bits of comedy. There's much serious parts with the role, and I just enjoy the show so much. Come and see it. It's really, I swear, it is worth it.
And Jerry, you've had fun, of course. The director is always in charge, totally. What? And something else you'd like to mention about the reason people should see this play?
Well, I think it's wonderful to get not only a live theater experience, but also experiences of cultures and times different than our own. And not only that, but also to realize the universality of these situations and how we can help ourselves and help our communities by learning and growing from the lessons that we learn from these great works of literature.
Can't say enough myself about the experience of live theater. And folks, it's just slightly more than a movie on Friday or Saturday night for adults and students with ID 10, children 12 and under, $6. Very, very special thing to do. When was the last time you supported live theater? And certainly everything here at HFCC are quality productions. Tell your friends about it, too. So Romeo and Juliet here, Thursday through Sundays, April 7th through 17th. I'm going to play the public service announcement that is now a must-play on our station, just so Jerry and Tim can hear it, but also so you can hear it. You'll be hearing it regularly as a reminder. A great thing to do, April 7th through 17th, Thursdays through Sundays, here at Henry Ford Community College. Thank you very much, Jerry Jablinski, director, and Tim as the friar.
Thank you, Jay.
Okay, here we go. Listen up, folks.
Henry Ford Community College's Fine Arts and Fitness Division proudly presents Shakespeare's great romantic tragedy, Romeo and Juliet, in HFCC's own Adrae Auditorium, located on the main campus at 5101 Evergreen Road, just south of Ford Road in Dearborn. Performances will run Thursdays through Sundays, April 7th to the 17th, with performances at 8 p.m. on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, and 2 p.m. on Sundays. This 90-minute condensed version is intended for smaller on-stage audiences and will be limited to only 100 seats per performance. Tickets are just $12 for adults, $10 for students with ID, and $7 per seat for groups of 10 or more. Make your reservations by calling 313-845-9817. That's 313-845-9817.
It took him some 80 years, but he has now made what looks to be a full comeback to power. He is Herbert Hoover. With the Great Depression spreading misery across America, President Hoover's prescription was to insist on reducing the size and spending of governments in order to boost business confidence. Hoovernomics was a disaster for our country, and it was not good for him. He lost the presidency in 1932 to FDR. So here we are in a new century with widespread, relentless unemployment, mass underemployment, stagnant wages, a rapidly falling middle class, and dimming economic prospects even for college-educated young Americans. In the face of this destabilizing, inegalitarian pressure on our economy and society, what remedy are America's corporate and political leaders demanding? Hoovernomics. Not a single jobs bill is in the congressional hopper. Despite rhetoric about a new green economy, the White House has offered no job creation plans at all. Instead, Washington's entire energy is going down the Hoover hole of restoring business confidence. The deficit is the devil, cry the new Hooverites, as they wildly slash spending and try to kill federal programs like Head Start that lift people up. Not to be outdone, a covey of extremist right-wing governors are demonizing, disempowering, and firing thousands of public employees. These little Hoovers maniacally shriek that with state revenues down and so many families out of work, the smart thing to do is to eliminate more jobs. They're shoving teachers, firefighters, and other public employees out the door, thus shutting off the taxes that these employees pay to the state while simultaneously increasing the number of out-of-work people looking for jobs. This is Jim Hightower saying, if ignorance is bliss, they must be ecstatic. Hoovernomics is back, as goofy and destructive today as it was last century. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
This is Jay and Dennis on the new WHFR Journal for Friday, April 1st, April Fool's Day, 2011. Nothing on this show is untrue as far as we know. Okay, we do have opinions, we state, and they might be untrue, but as far as we know, they are true, and it's certainly expressions of how we and other people believe here. Looking at some of the headlines from the Dearborn Press and Guide and the Dearborn Times Herald this week, Dearborn Heights City Clerk Walter Przewuski.
Ooh, nice.
Dennis, can you do that? Przewuski. Probably he just says it quickly. I know a lot of Polish folks just say, just sort of sneeze after my
that's
the
what
first
I do.
Letter.
And, I'm Polish.
And
that's
no
I
disrespect.
Do.
That's Przewuicz. And he is a retired person from some other occupation, but was chosen by the Dearborn Heights City Council as the next city clerk, taking office almost immediately. One of the council persons, and this was in both the story in the Press and Guide and the Times Herald, our own Ned Apigian. I say our own because he's been a member of the WHFR staff for many years, and he does the forum show once every 2 or 3 months, Dearborn Heights News and Views. We had a session this Tuesday, and that's the 29th, so if you want to go to the WHFR.fm website, click on forum and click on 329. That's Dearborn Heights News and Views for this week. We actually had the Dearborn Heights police chief, and his name is Lee Garvin, and also the city of Dearborn police chief here, Ronald Haddad, for sort of a comparison discussion about the relationships between the two cities. How are things done differently? The whole question about that came up throughout the way about combining services to save money. I mean, after all, both cities have Dearborn in their name. So something, for example, that I think they agreed on, like dispatchers. Both areas, these are the people that take the calls, take the reports that are coming in from people requesting police services, and they decide how to handle them. I mean, you can't just instantly send police officers. Maybe they need a health team to come out instead. In other words, maybe it's a medical problem or maybe some other kind of issue. And so the dispatchers have to be very well trained in exactly interpreting what kind of service is being requested and getting the right people there and, of course, as speedily as possible. Well, Ned asked, I know at one point, well, why does Dearborn Heights have like 16 people? We're half the size, and Dearborn's got 18 people. And of course, there was an easy answer. There's only 24 hours in the day,
right.
And you got to have enough people there. You know, just like air traffic controllers, whether you've got a big airport or a little airport, if that controller or dispatcher, for example, needs to go to the bathroom or take an emergency personal call, even you've got to have someone behind them, and you actually need people always supporting them if they need additional research. Or communications. They can only talk to one person at a time on the phone, and yet they got to do other things to get those services going, too. So apparently Dearborn Heights has a few more part-timers, well-trained, though. But almost every community that has a police department needs the same number of dispatchers since they have to be there 24/7 and they need backup. Mr. Chief Haddad of Dearborn agreed, yes, we could have a regional police dispatch operation, which might save costs, but they've all got to be well coordinated and so on. And for example, if something, Ned said, what if something happens right on the border, like on Telegraph between Dearborn Heights, Dearborn, who gets the call? Well, Dearborn Heights might, or Dearborn might, but then they got to transfer the call back. And then if they need help, well, do we call Dearborn for help too? Because maybe they've got cars that are closer to respond, police cars at that moment. you know, to that that problem if it is on the border. So a regional dispatch office wouldn't have that problem. Right. Everybody would they just pick the car that's closest to go and get there quickest. And Dennis, being on top of the news, indicated the Michigan Chronicle, the current edition, I think, had support for. And I haven't looked at it, Dennis. Sorry, okay. Didn't get time. I was cross-checking all these stories. I thought, whoa, look at this story on the internet. And I clicked through it and find out it's an April Fool's joke.
The one that I...
Seriously, not yours.
Oh.
No, but other ones. So I got behind on my major sources because they had this... And that's why I don't like April Fool's Day. Just waste time. Maybe you should just phone things in, folks. Don't even go outside your door. Don't look at the internet. Don't read the papers.
Shame on them.
You know, maybe 20 to 30% of your day is going to be misdirected.
Right.
And mistaken, even. So you got to be careful there. You
don't
know.
Even get out of bed.
Right.
Well, no, the one I saw, it was a big headline that said that basically it was, to paraphrase, we should, it wasn't even saying we should do anything. It was talking, it was on the topic of combining the services of all of the communities in all three counties to right. become one big city.
Which you remember was that was a somewhat controversial proposal by Jack Lessenberry.
A few weeks ago,
And all urban planning professors with doctorates all around the country have said this for years. Large metropolitan areas like Detroit mm-hmm. need to be governed by one government with one team of services. That's the most efficient, the most effective way to pool the monies involved and for schools too and to get things done with plenty of local input from all these communities still. And the best, most successful metro communities in the U.S. that extend out 100 miles or more mm-hmm. from the city hall are run that way. Now, again, I don't want this personally, my opinion. I don't want this forced on us by Governor Snyder's emergency management teams.
Right.
Okay, which will, you know, and right now, folks, you know, that it is a law. It is in effect. Even if the city or the school district is not broken, is not bankrupt and in debt, they can still go, they can go in at any time they feel like it now. Thank you, Republican legislators and Republican governor, for doing any time they feel, oh, well, they wouldn't go in unless it was really a problem.
That's not true.
Anytime they could. This is potential. This is a Glenn Beck rant here. I'm going to do my impersonation of. This is socialism, folks. This is Marxism. This is dictatorship. Okay, I don't know if Glenn ever threatens that. But that's what it is, and it's the Republicans that have put this mechanism in place. Well, they wouldn't do it unless it was really needed. Let's not even have that in place. It's like the Patriot Act from after 9/11. You know, that was Republican too, remember, where none of us really have any rights. If who's ever in the government wants to go and grab us and throw us in jail and say we're a terrorist, we've got no defense. We don't have a right to a speedy trial anymore. We don't have a right to attorney. They can keep us sequestered in prison in the U.S. or somewhere else at some hellhole elsewhere in the world with no right to counsel and no right to a speedy trial anymore just because the government says, oh, we think they're terrorists. Okay, well, prove it. That's what I say. That's so un-American, and it's so un-American to have this emergency management threat hanging over these communities. Just think of what Robert Bob has done to the Detroit public school system. Maybe some of that was necessary. But what's really important here, I think, I mean, I have to agree with Jack Lessenberry, if our politicians had the guts to do it right, they would keep local control, but they would merge, whether it's the tri-county or whatever it is, they would merge a significant metropolitan area into one city and one taxation base, one set of services, and this would probably include Dearborn Heights, okay?
Well, not probably,
and,
for sure.
And the rest of the county areas going downriver, maybe right. all the way to Trenton, I don't know,
sure.
Would have to.
Out to Lake Livonia, maybe?
Wyandotte, at least Livonia, if right. not northwest of maybe Farmington even.
Right.
And so, you know, an urban planner, a significantly intelligent people who have been studying these things for decades, they know how to draw the lines of the new city, Detroit,
right.
which would reinvigorate and redirect all the good agendas, and we could keep it under control. Not the state, not the federal government, but we keep it under control. But will our legislators in Lansing, the Republicans, do it this way? No, I don't think they will. No, and besides, you know what their agenda is, cut the poor and their lifelines. And they've already proven that by the bills introduced, although not passed into law yet, thank goodness. Cut out unions, cut out public employee benefits. And, you know, I guess there's not going to be any middle class. There's going to be the rich, and there's going to be the people at the poverty line pretty soon.
And guess because what? The bigger percentage will be not the rich.
Right. The one thing I learned, too, from the forum on Tuesday with the two police chiefs of Dearborn Heights, they haven't gotten a pay raise in 5 years.
Right.
You know, they're about 59,000. They're about the same as teachers. Oh, well, they have all those benefits. Well, don't they deserve them? I mean, you know, teachers go way beyond the typical workday with paper checking. In fact, I was interested today, and I'm not sure if I'm supposed to talk about it because it says this is subject to, you know, privacy.
Then for sure.
But it was on the internet, and my daughter, who works in Southfield, sent it to me. It's not a bad idea, though. There's going to be a grade-in taking place at Lakeside Mall April 16th, starting at 9:30 a.m. I think that's probably a Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a Saturday. And it's a group of teachers. They're all going to go there, not just from Southfield, but elsewhere, to sit down and grade papers in public.
Okay.
To increase public awareness that we're not simply working 8 to 3, 5 days a week, 9 months out of the year. And apparently these kinds of events are popping up all over the country. It's just, you know, police, fire, we know about the seriousness of their job and the risks that they're to their own lives they're putting out there. And my daughter's story, which is only slightly exaggerated by myself, she has those threats. She says, welcome, she's going to put up a sign, she says, welcome to Thunderdome,
yeah,
on her classroom door. Because every day her students, and most of them are special needs people as identified legally, and she's not qualified to teach them, but that's where they put them in her classroom. Two-thirds of her students are that there is violence. There is throwing of tables, chairs, fights between students, chairs thrown, tables at her. This is going on, she says, every day, and I think almost every day is probably the truth. I can only guess what's going on in Detroit with even less staffing.
And bigger classrooms.
Well, going the fall, they're saying 65 students per classroom.
That's
unmanageable.
Absolutely.
Unteachable.
Unfathomable.
So I think my daughter needs that sort of extra battle pay. But what is she getting? She's getting a middle-class salary with, health benefits and insurance that's better than the average public sector worker. But give me a comparable job to teaching in the public sector. Give me a comparable job to police and fire in the public sector. Oh, security guards at a corporate facility, maybe. But is there really the constant danger and the variety of challenges in these facilities? I don't think so.
Well, and the danger is a whole different one in the classroom because a teacher's hands are tied to a huge degree as opposed to the police and another enforcement.
The most educated and therefore the most successful systems in the world are in Sweden and Japan. And I don't know what's left of Japan to comment on, but before there are three crises this year, so unfortunate, so sad. The best school systems were in Japan and the best teachers in Sweden, and they had the highest pay rates of any workers there, higher than in the U.S. even. They could attract the best people.
Right.
They had the best functioning systems. They got the best results.
Get what you pay
Don't
for.
We want that in America? Absolutely. To a certain extent, you do, except maybe some of the bankers and fund managers in New York City. I don't understand their million-dollar salaries. I'm sorry, I was raised in a worker's family. My dad worked at Chrysler Corporation on the assembly line. I do not understand how somebody is worth tens of millions of dollars a year. They don't have the risk. Oh, they got financial risk, but they're protected. The government's going to bail them out like we did 3 years ago. I mean, and now those same people are still getting bonuses, and they didn't lose a darn thing. The only thing that's being lost here, which is so unfair, and Jim Hightower has already commented about once this hour, is the teachers, the firefighters, the policemen, and of course the public employees in state and local government. It's a small cost savings to hurt them. But these are the people doing the most for us. Really?
But we're always gonna. There's always gonna be industries that we feel are proportionally overpaid and underpaid. I mean, that's gonna happen. Back to what you were talking about regarding the city and the counties. When we spoke about it earlier, you made a really good point that a lot of the suburbs, if not all of them, might resist this. They want Detroit Water. They mm-hmm. want other things. Mm-hmm. And they want, and let's face it, the suburbs.
They want control of the Detroit water system.
Right. But they want the city. Yeah. They want the city. Mm-hmm. Who wouldn't want the city to flourish and blossom? But are they willing to invest what it would take? And part of that is giving up their own community and becoming part of a bigger one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I understand. And that's the first thing you said is, well, wouldn't the suburbs resist? And I have to agree. They probably will.
It seems to me about 10 minutes ago, I was talking about Ned Apigian, and he was actually, he abstained from voting for the new Dearborn Heights City Clerk person, because apparently the next election is 49 days away,
right.
And in that election, they're going to elect a new clerk.
Okay.
Why not? And he said, why hire two new people, which is what they've done,
right?
At this point, when it might all be changed in 49 days, we could just continue... And the previous city clerk person is willing to stay there in the interim for either less or the same pay, though she's officially retired.
Huh.
He made a good point, but of course he's odd man out. Ned, I think, has sat in on the Journal show too many times where we take alternative points of view for good reason.
No, absolutely.
You know, and we try to give time, like we will next week, to a special guest that will present something of large scale answer to an awful lot of problems. It really sounds good. Would anybody be brave enough to try it? Probably not. Like the consolidation of the Tri-County area into one city. Great answer. Highly recommended for decades by the smartest people about urban planning and metro governance and working in other places of the country. But would we be brave enough to try it? Again, next week, we hope the special guest, I think by phone, is going to be
right.
Don Dabrowski, mm-hmm. who is going to speak for the Michigan Fair Tax in detail, which we brought up with numerous politicians just to see how much they know and have thought about other ideas other than the day-to-day push and shove from lobbyists and their own parties. And I think Michigan Fair Tax, just like the consolidation of the Tri-County area approximately, it transcends. I think we talked to Duraney last week, George Duraney, Michigan rep here, about the Michigan Bank, the
right.
state, the setting up of a Michigan Bank for all kinds of small business investments, and it's been done elsewhere, made a huge success, I think, in Wisconsin. Were we brave enough to try it? It's not a Republican or a Democratic issue.
Right.
It's good for everybody. And by the way, I just here's another of Cornick's opinions on April Fool's Day, but I'm not fooling. shared sacrifice. The governor isn't taking his governor's pay. He's just taking a dollar.
Right.
God bless him. Yeah, but how many other millions is he still making because he's still part of all of his previous companies? Okay, come on. Would he raise taxes on himself? One of the rich people in the state hasn't proposed that, folks. Oh, no, hasn't proposed that.
Well, at the same time, I mean, and we all knew it would be, it's a token gesture. It's symbolic more than anything else to, there's more money than I'm leaving in the pie. I know what you're saying,
right.
But we can't fault him for making money legitimately as a businessman prior to being governor.
No, he hasn't outsourced too many jobs from his own company recently.
I guess what I can say is a lot of the reasons, one of the big reasons why he got elected is because he can manage money reasonably well, and that's what we're looking for.
And he does tend to look very closely at these issues and try to make, I think, an objective decision about what needs to be done. I've read a few of the bills he's signed already on different smaller issues, less controversial ones, very well thought through.
I
can support
position.
Most of what he's already signed into law, which is minor areas, a tweaking of the Environmental Protection Agency in Michigan and other. I mean, just he hasn't done a bad job of trying to completely analyze many issues and come up with new solutions.
Right.
But some of the things proposed and some of the myriad, I mean, it's almost three dozen laws now introduced by Republican legislatures, most of them first time in the legislature, that are just crazy. They're just disaster if actually voted into law the way they sit.
Some of them, don't you think they're just doing it just to do something?
To tell their people, oh, look what I did. You wanted me to vote to kill government, and here's my bill to do it. But, of course, we need government for many good things.
I don't want Schneider's job. I mean, do you envy him? That's a tough – he's got a challenge.
Yeah, well, you know, when he was campaigning, he said he would look closely at the filmmaking incentive program from the Michigan Film Office, and that he would make the right decision, and yet he proposed in his State of the State address to kill it and replace it with upfront production grants.
Right.
And, oh my gosh, where is it here? IndieWire.com today.
No.
Okay, it's sitting here somewhere, folks. We have so many stories. I'll just summarize it. IndieWire.com, 2 days ago, they had a summary of the effects nationwide and how Michigan is perceived now in terms of the film incentive program. And here's the summary. Filmmakers are leaving Michigan, and they're even giving up on grants they already have. They're not even trying to get grants. By the way, the Michigan Film Office has already taken Governor Snyder's suggestion and is following his new guidelines, and that is, okay, well, maybe you should just apply for grants now. But it hasn't even been changed officially into law. So we are losing big-time business. This is the case all across the country. Filmmakers, in fact, the one I heard today, and this is on the Craig Folly Show, and no kidding there either, we have actually had a $52 million project stop, which was approved, stop, and they're going to go somewhere else. I don't know if it's just a token thing, but they can't trust the state and what they might do, even though they've been approved.
Right.
So this is $52 million that would have been spent right here in Michigan on a variety of jobs, small to big, and they're not going to come now.
Because they're apprehensive. And that's the thing, is everything I've read about this is they are going, movies are so expensive to make that if you can get the kind of deal we were offering, that's why they've flocked here, and that's why they're flocking away. And there are other states that offer
our journalism similar ones. Class on campus under the direction this time by Kirk Krug, who is a writer frequently for the Dearborn Press and Guide.
Yes.
And he also teaches other English classes here, but he actually sicked. Is that the right word? He actually recommended Susan McGraw and myself as resources on the Michigan Film Incentive Plan. And unfortunately, of course, they wanted most of them that approached me, and I had more than a half dozen. I had six or seven. And they wanted quotes.
Yeah.
They wanted short, succinct quotes.
Well, maybe from Susan they'll get a short.
They did not. They did not ever, except on my instigation, go to michiganfilmoffice.org and read the details of the current film incentive. So in other words, how can they do a good story full of quotes when they don't know what the real facts are?
They might publish
the quotes from authoritative people who should know what they're talking about and never really check the facts, which are right there to read. So I printed out, because he seemed interested, and I did this for him. I printed out the 7-page PDF file of the details of the past, and still current, actually, if it would be acted on, film incentive program. The details are so carefully set up that anybody getting an incentive after the film is made and released, it has to be made and released, and then they can apply for the tax credit back. Yes, they might get as much as 42% of their cost returned to them by the state of Michigan. But along the way, they have to invest so much money in Michigan that it's almost an even break. Not quite, but almost. This is what's needed. This is an incentive that'll set up this industry, film and television production, which we're always going to use, always going to entertain ourselves to death. You know that, folks. And it could happen right here in Michigan. It'll be more needed and more important in the future, even for other kinds of film and video production, advertising, public relations, news, in the various media. And it'd be great to have those industries here. What happened in New Mexico 3 decades ago, they gave about 45-50% tax credit. They've established so-called native cottage industries, studios, production people. They're there now in New Mexico, and they've reduced their incentive because they don't really need it anymore. They've got quality people, and they've still got it. I think it's 20-25%.
Yeah, that's the point.
But because people, we love New Mexico. We've been there before. We know the people. They got great facilities. facilities and talent. Well, we've already got the talent thanks to the former people that were here for media with the auto industry. They're, most of them are still around here, and this incentive wouldn't have had to continue more than, say, I think 3 to 5 years. They could have cut back, but the break-even is great. Now, Snyder, with his $25 million, well, $25 million of grants, that's not a chump change. They're giving it up front. Right. Who knows if the movie will ever be finished? I guess if it isn't finished, they're going to ask for the money back. But that's not
good
even
luck.
In place yet.
Good luck.
You know, and it's not going to establish any large-scale business. It's, everything is dead now. If this is put into place, if this is not turned around, if Governor Snyder doesn't change his position on this incentive, forget about that industry. Of course, there's some other industries that he could be supporting. Alternative energy, renewable energy, alternative energy storage, you know, like battery, and cars, the Motor City. Maybe we could be that again if we would get incentive money to take us a direct right. He said, well, Obama gave incentive. He gave incentive money that basically says, do the same thing.
How about we pay our teachers the highest in the country, yeah, and then they'll flock,
okay,
here? Great
or,
idea.
Or make the environment safe. You know, we got some of the worst toxic waste dumps in the country. I understand people are flocking away from Whitehall, which is just right north of Muskegon, because that's one of the worst toxic waste spills in the country, and some of it is leaching into the groundwater now. Talk about Japan and the radiation. It's not radiation, but it's toxic chemicals. We need to clean that up. Michigan, a great tourist state, clean water, clean air. Not quite, folks. It won't last long unless we get some money in there, and then we'll keep the tourists coming in. And so I've seen no major initiatives on Snyder's part for new directions that we need that will help everybody and save us money in the long run. You know, we don't have to be dependent on oil and coal or nuclear. You know, gee whiz. Okay, so that's my little rant about the governor. Good guy, going in the right direction. I don't understand how a guy that smart and having done so much research on these other issues can just kill the film incentive program. It's not going to save that much money, and long term, it would be money well spent to continue it. If you look at the details, it's not just we're giving money away, which is what he proposes. Just give money away.
Right.
You know, just give the grants up front. Well, nobody wants those. That's not the way it works in other states that have made money on this and established a new industry. That's not the way it is. So I hope people, you know, I'll be quoted correctly for the journalism class, which is not the newspaper even that Dennis is the editor of here on campus. But I hope we get the story out, and I hope reporters also do their research on the real facts and then maybe not use some quotes when they don't agree with the research, in fact.
Right.
Oh, well. Coming up to the top of the hour, there we are. Look at that, 2 o'clock sharp. It's WHFR Dearborn. We're waiting for Joanne Korchinska to arrive for another great 4 hours of great blues music here. Big event on campus today, and she may have a place to park problem because just in an hour, and they're already getting everything changed around with parking on campus, they're going to do groundbreaking for the new science building.
That's kind of cool.
They're going to be expanding, I think, by 2. They're going to be putting a roof that grows trees and plants on it to save in insulation and to help clean the air. So all kinds of great thank you, State of Michigan. I don't think you're doing it for anybody else, because we got the last grant for a new building anywhere in Michigan at higher ed facilities. We're paying half of the cost, but we got a lot of famous people, local representatives. I'm sure Durrani is here. Maybe